Is there a link, Arietti wondered, between Roques's moral strength and his mental illness? Many years later, after he had moved to America and become one of the world's foremost scholars on mental illness, Arietti would publish a book, The Parnas, A Scene from the Holocaust, 1979, in which he recounted what happened in Pisa after the Germans occupied part of Italy. Throughout 1943 and 1944, as first the Italian fascists and then the Nazis terrorized Pisa's Jewish community, most Jews fled. But Roques, prevented by his anxiety from traveling, stayed in Pisa. The idea of going far away from home to another city or to the country increases my anxiety to the point of panic, Roques told six friends who chose for various reasons to remain in the city with him. I know that these fears are absurd to the point of being ridiculous, but it is useless to tell myself so. I cannot overcome them. When his followers tried to attribute his willingness to brave bombs and Nazis to courage or spiritual grace, Roques demurred. His illness, he said, has caused such a narrowing of my life, not to mention gossip and ridicule, and has shadowed my whole existence. I live trembling with a totally irrational fear of animals, especially of dogs. I also have a fear of the fear itself. Had I not felt this sick fear constantly, I would not be here. I would be far away. What you call a special gift is illness. But the fact that his fear of dogs was greater than his fear of bombs and Nazis made him appear brave. Early on the morning of August 1, 1944, the Nazis arrived at Roques's home and demanded that he surrender the guests who were staying with him. He refused. "Aren't you afraid of dying?" the Nazis demanded. "We will kill you, you filthy Jew." "I am not afraid," he told them. And according to those who survived and were later interviewed by Arietti, Roques manifestly was not afraid, even though he knew the Nazis were about to murder him. As real danger approached, he appeared to be free of fear. In his book, Arietti elaborates a theory about why this should have been the case. His view was that Roques's phobia of and disgust at animals was a displacement of his disgust at the evil inherent in man. As a young boy, Roques had been happy and optimistic. But during his studies as an adolescent, he discovered the facts of the Crusades, the Inquisition, and the myriad other horrors that man has visited upon man across history. He couldn't bear this. To preserve a loving view of humankind and a view of the world as a friendly place, Arietti theorizes, Roques projected onto animals the evil that is in man, preferring to fear animals rather than give up his view of mankind as essentially good. When Roques was confronted unavoidably with evil in the form of the Nazis, his animal phobia disappeared. This, Arietti argues, gives his phobic anxiety an almost spiritual quality, since it permitted him to displace revulsion and anxiety onto insentient creatures, allowing him to retain love for humankind. When the sensitive youngster has made these unpleasant realizations about the evil in man and the danger and hardship of existence, Arietti writes, he has difficulties in facing life. How can he trust? How can he love or retain a loving attitude towards fellow human beings? He might then become suspicious and paranoid. He might become a detached person, unable to love. But this is not the case with the phobic. The phobic is a person who retains his ability to love. As a matter of fact, in my long psychiatric career, I have never seen a phobic person who was not a loving person. We are born, it seems, into a Rousseauian state of innocence. But if we accurately observe life and human nature, we must adopt a Hobbesian defensive crouch against life's depredations. Phobias sublimate our Hobbesian horror into neurotic and irrational fears, Arietti argues, allowing us to preserve a more innocent and loving stance toward the world. Giuseppe Pardo Roques was not the only Pisan imprisoned by his anxiety during the war. When the bombs started falling, reducing parts of the city to rubble, most people left. But Pietro, a young man who lived not far from Roques, could not go more than a block from his house. His agoraphobia would not permit it. So he stayed home. Pietro would sooner have had a bomb dropped on his head than endure the terror that seized him when he walked too far from his house. The fear caused by the neurosis was stronger than the fear of the dangers of the war, Arietti observes. Pietro survived the war and ended up decorated as a hero for his courage. After each bombing, he would run out into the ruins, so long as they were within a block of his house, and free people trapped in them. In this way, he saved several lives. Only because he was constrained by his phobia was he available to help the bombing victims. His illness made him become a hero, Arietti writes. To someone who suffers from anxiety, the stories of Roques and Pietro and of Bill Russell and Floyd Patterson hold obvious appeal. In their anxiety lies not just redemption, but a source of moral heroism, and even, perhaps, a strange sort of courage. Part 3. Drugs. Chapter 5. A Sack of Enzymes. From time immemorial, drugs have been making possible some degree of self-transcendence and a temporary release from tension. Aldous Huxley, in a May 9, 1957 presentation to the New York Academy of Science. Wine, drunk with an equal quantity of water, puts away anxiety and terror. Hippocrates, Aphorisms, 4th century BC. In anticipation of the release of my first book in the spring of 2004, my publisher arranged a modest publicity tour that entailed national television and radio appearances, as well as bookstore readings and public lectures around the country. This should have been a delightful prospect, the chance to promote my book, to travel on someone else's nickel, to connect with readers, to achieve a kind of temporary two-bit celebrity. But I can scarcely convey what powerful dread this book tour conjured in me. In desperation, I sought help from multiple sources. I first went to a prominent Harvard psychopharmacologist who had been recommended by my principal psychiatrist a year earlier. "You have an anxiety disorder," the psychopharmacologist had told me after taking my case history at our initial consultation. "Fortunately, this is highly treatable. We just need to get you properly medicated." When I gave him my standard objections to reliance on medication, worry about side effects, concerns about drug dependency, discomfort with the idea of taking pills that might affect my mind and change who I am, he resorted to the cliched but nonetheless potent diabetes argument, which goes like this. Your anxiety has a biological, physiological, and genetic basis. It is a medical illness, just like diabetes is. If you were a diabetic, you wouldn't have such qualms about taking insulin, would you? And you wouldn't see your diabetes as a moral failing, would you? I'd had versions of this discussion with various psychiatrists many times over the years. I would try to resist whatever the latest drug was, feeling that this resistance was somehow noble or moral, that reliance on medication evinced weakness of character, that my anxiety was an integral and worthwhile component of who I am, and that there was redemption in suffering. Until, inevitably, my anxiety would become so acute that I would be willing to try anything, including the new medication. So, as usual, I capitulated, and as the book tour loomed, I resumed a course of benzodiazepines, Xanax during the day, Klonopin at night, and increased my dosage of Celexa, the SSRI antidepressant I was already taking. But even drugged to the gills, I remained filled with dread about the impending book tour, so I went also to a young but highly regarded Stanford-trained psychologist who specialized in cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. First thing we've got to do, she said in one of my early sessions with her, is to get you off these drugs. A few sessions later, she offered to take my Xanax from me and lock it in a drawer in her desk. She opened the drawer to show me the bottles deposited there by some of her other patients, holding one up and shaking it for effect. The drugs, she said, were a crutch that prevented me from truly experiencing and thereby confronting my anxiety. If I didn't expose myself to the raw experience of anxiety, I would never learn that I could cope with it on my own. She was right, I knew. Exposure therapy is based on fully experiencing your anxiety, which is hard to do if you're taking anti-anxiety medications. But with the book tour looming, my fear was that I might not, in fact, be able to cope with it. I went back to the Harvard psychopharmacologist, let's call him Dr. Harvard, and described the course of action the Stanford psychologist, let's call her Dr. Stanford, had proposed. "It's your call," he said. "You could try giving up the medication, but your anxiety is clearly so deeply rooted in your biology that even mild stress provokes it. Only medication can control your biological reaction. And it may well be that your anxiety is so acute that the only way you'll be able to get to the point where any kind of behavioral therapy can begin to be effective is by taking the edge off your physical symptoms with drugs." "What if I get addicted to Xanax and have to be on it all my life?" I asked. "Benzodiazepines are notorious for inducing dependency. Withdrawing too suddenly from them can produce horrific side effects." "So what if you do?" he said. "I have a patient coming in this afternoon who's been taking it for 20 years. She couldn't live without it." At my next session with Dr. Stanford, I told her I was afraid to give up my Xanax and related what Dr. Harvard had said to me. She looked betrayed. I thought for a moment that she might cry. After that, I stopped telling her about my visits to Dr. Harvard. My continued consultations with him felt illicit. Dr. Stanford was more likable and more pleasant to talk to than Dr. Harvard. She tried to understand what caused my anxiety and seemed to care about me as an individual personality. Dr. Harvard, on the other hand, seemed to see me as a type, an anxiety patient, to be treated with a one-size-fits-all solution, drugs. One day I read in the newspaper that he was treating a depressed gorilla at the local zoo. Dr. Harvard's treatment of choice for the gorilla in question? Celexa, the same SSRI he was prescribing for me. I can't say for certain whether the drug worked for the gorilla. Reportedly, it did. But could there be a more potent demonstration that Dr. Harvard's approach to treatment was resolutely biological? For him, the content of any psychic distress, and certainly the meaning of it, mattered less than the fact of it. Such distress, whether in a human or some other primate, was a medical biological malfunction that could be fixed with drugs. What to do? Dr. Harvard was telling me that I, like the gorilla, had a medical problem in need of pharmaceutical intervention. Dr. Stanford was telling me that my problem was not principally biological, but rather cognitive. If I could simply correct dysfunctions in how I thought, through force of will and cognitive retraining and direct exposure to my greatest fears, then my anxiety would be reduced. But the drugs I was on, Dr. Stanford said, were impeding my ability to address those dysfunctions in an effective way. Actually, Dr. Stanford also conceded a strong biological component to anxiety. Her view was that biology can be overcome by cognitive retraining. And research does suggest that cognitive retraining, as well as other forms of talk therapy, can change biology in the same way that medication does, sometimes more profoundly and enduringly, a literal manifestation of mind over matter. I kept trying to give up my Klonopin and Xanax in order to do proper cognitive retraining, and I would sometimes even succeed at this in small ways, only to be overwhelmed with anxiety again and resort to fumbling miserably through my pockets for the Xanax. As much as I would have liked to have cured myself through fixing my thinking or achieving spiritual peace, or simply learning to cope. I seemed always to be ending up like the depressed gorilla, in need of artificial adjustments to my neurotransmitters to fix my anxious, broken brain. Tranquilizers, by attenuating the disruptive influence of anxiety on the mind, open the way to a better and more coordinated use of the existing gifts. By doing this, they are adding to happiness, human achievement, and the dignity of man. Frank Berger, Anxiety and the Discovery of Tranquilizers, in Discoveries in Biological Psychiatry, 1970. To what extent would Western culture be altered by widespread use of tranquilizers? Would Yankee initiative disappear? Is the chemical deadening of anxiety harmful? Stanley Yollis, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, in testimony given to the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Small Business, May 1967. Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, relied heavily on drugs in managing his anxiety. Six of his earliest scientific papers were on the benefits of cocaine, which he used regularly for at least a decade, beginning in the 1880s. "In my last serious depression, I took cocaine again," he wrote to his wife in 1884, "and a small dose lifted me to the heights in a wonderful fashion. I am just now collecting the literature for a song of praise to this magical substance." He believed his research on the drug's medicinal properties would make him famous. Deeming the drug to be no more addictive than coffee, he prescribed it, to himself and to others, as a treatment for everything from nervous tension and melancholy to indigestion and morphine addiction. Freud called cocaine a magic drug. "I take very small doses of it regularly against depression and against indigestion, and with the most brilliant success." He also took it to alleviate his social anxiety before the evening salons he attended at the Paris home of his mentor Jean-Martin Charcot. Freud was also, by his own admission, addicted to nicotine, smoking 20 or more cigars a day for most of his life, a habit that would reward him with mouth cancer in his 60s. Only after he prescribed cocaine to a close friend, who went on to become fatally addicted, did Freud's enthusiasm for the drug wane. But by then, Freud's own experience with cocaine had solidified his conviction that some mental illnesses have a physical basis in the brain. It is an irony of medical history that even as Freud's later work would make him the progenitor of modern psychodynamic psychotherapy, which is generally premised on the idea that mental illness arises from unconscious psychological conflicts, his papers on cocaine make him one of the fathers of biological psychiatry, which is governed by the notion that mental distress is partly caused by a physical or chemical malfunction that can be treated with drugs. Much of the history of modern psychopharmacology has the same ad hoc quality as Freud's experimentation with cocaine. Every one of the most commercially significant classes of anti-anxiety and antidepressant drugs of the last 60 years was discovered by accident, or was originally developed for something completely unrelated to anxiety or depression. To treat tuberculosis, surgical shock, allergies, to use as an insecticide, a penicillin preservative, an industrial dye, a disinfectant, rocket fuel. Yet despite its haphazardness, the recent history of psychopharmacology has shaped our modern understanding of mental illness. Recall that neither anxiety nor depression, two terms that today have become part of both the medical and the popular lexicon, existed as clinical categories half a century ago. Before the 1920s, no one had ever been diagnosed with depression. Before the 1950s, hardly anyone was diagnosed with straightforward anxiety. So what changed? One answer is that pharmaceutical companies, in effect, created these categories. What began as targets for marketing campaigns eventually became reified as diseases. By this, I do not mean to suggest that before the 1950s, people were not anxious or depressed in the senses we understand those words today. Some people, some percentage of the time, have always felt pathologically unhappy and afraid. This was the case for millennia before the terms anxiety and depression were popularized to describe emotional states or clinical disorders. The tears of the world are a constant quantity, as Samuel Beckett put it. But not until the middle of the last century, when new drugs geared toward mitigating these emotional states were concocted, did these states get delimited as the diseases we understand them to be today. Before 1906, when the fledgling Food and Drug Administration started requiring drug makers to list their products' ingredients, consumers didn't realize that in taking some of the most popular anti-anxiety remedies of the time, such as Neurocene or Dr. Miles's Nervine, advertised as the scientific remedy for nervous disorders, or Weller's Nerve Vitalizers, or Rexall's Americanitis Elixir, they were ingesting alcohol or marijuana or opium. Some doctors prescribed straight alcohol. In the 1890s, Adolphus Bridger, an influential London physician and the author of such popular medical books as The Demon of Dyspepsia and Man and His Maladies, told patients suffering from tension and melancholy to drink port and brandy. He wrote that a suitable form of alcohol, especially full-bodied burgundy, high-class claret, port, the better white, French, German, and Italian wines, stout or good brandy, would do more to restore nervous health than any other medicine. In 1897, the German drug company Bayer began marketing diacetyl morphine, a compound that had been widely used on the battlefields of the American Civil War and the Franco-Prussian War as a painkiller and cough suppressant. This new medication, under the trade name heroin, was available in American pharmacies without a prescription until 1914. 2 years later, Bayer brought out another analgesic, acetyl salicylic acid, under the brand name aspirin. In time, as heroin and aspirin became ubiquitous, both went from being brand names to generic terms. Turn-of-the-century physicians in America and England had a somewhat backward understanding of these medications, often giving heroin to their patients for physical pain, which in fairness made a certain sense, and administering aspirin for nervousness, which did not. The 1899 edition of the Merck Manual, then, as now, a respected compendium of the most up-to-date medical information, recommended opium as a standard treatment for anxiety. The serene confidence with which the Merck Manual, as well as the physicians and apothecaries of the time, glibly dispensed recommendations for drugs we now know to be addictive, unhealthy, or useless, raises the question of whether we should place much trust in the similarly serene confidence of the physicians and drug manuals of today. Yes, today's researchers and clinicians are armed with data from controlled studies and findings from neuroimaging and blood assays, and they are buttressed, or held back, depending on your perspective, by a more cautious FDA that demands years' worth of animal testing and clinical trials before a drug can be approved for sale. But 100 years from now, medical historians may once again be marveling at the addictive, toxic, or useless substances we consume in such great quantities today. For the first half of the 20th century, barbiturates were the most popular remedy for strained nerves. Originally synthesized in 1864 by a German chemist who combined condensed urea, found in animal waste, with diethyl malonate, which derives from the acid in apples, barbituric acid seemed at first to have no productive use. But in 1903, when researchers at Bayer gave barbituric acid to dogs, the dogs fell asleep. Within months, Bayer was marketing Barbitol, the first commercially available barbiturate, to consumers. Bayer named the drug Veronol because one of its scientists believed Verona, Italy, to be the most peaceful city on Earth. In 1911, the company released a longer-acting barbiturate, phenobarbital, under the trade name Luminol, which would go on to become the most popular drug in the category. By the 1930s, barbiturates had almost completely displaced their late 19th century predecessors, chloral hydrate and bromides, as well as opium, as the treatment of choice for nerve troubles. Potassium bromide, a compound introduced at a British medical conference in 1857, was originally used as an anti-seizure medication and was, from the late 19th century into the early 20th, popular as a sedative. Eventually, the toxicity and side effects of bromides, ranging from a bitter aftertaste and acne to dizziness, severe nausea, and vomiting, led to their abandonment. Today they are used almost exclusively in veterinary medicine for dogs and cats with epilepsy. But their use was widespread enough for long enough that the word bromide also came to mean a soporific platitude. Chloral hydrate, a sleep-inducing agent first synthesized in 1832, was added to doctors' psychotropic toolkit in 1869 after Otto Liebrich, a professor of pharmacology in Berlin, gave the substance to melancholic patients and observed that it alleviated their insomnia. 100 years later, my great-grandfather would be prescribed chloral hydrate for his tension and insomnia. Chloral hydrate was also one of the active ingredients, along with alcohol, in the Mickey Finn, a doctored drink that often featured in Depression-era potboilers. As early as 1906, so many Americans were taking and sometimes overdosing on Veronol that the New York Times editorialized against the overprescription of such quick-cure nostrums, but to little effect. In the 1930s, the Merck Manual was still recommending Veronol for the treatment of extreme nervousness, neurasthenia, hypochondria, melancholia, and other conditions of anxiety. Veronol and Luminol, advertised as aspirin for the mind, dominated what would today be called the anxiety medication market for decades. By 1947, there were 30 different barbiturates being sold under separate trade names in the United States. The three most popular were Amitol, Amobarbital, Nembutol, Pentobarbital, and Secanol, Secobarbital. Since anxiety and depression didn't officially exist yet, the barbiturates tended to be prescribed for nerves or nerve troubles, tension, and insomnia. But the barbiturates had two big drawbacks. They were highly addictive, and accidental overdoses were common and often lethal. In 1950, at least 1,000 Americans fatally overdosed on barbiturates. My great-grandmother and Marilyn Monroe, among many others, would go on to do so in the 1960s. In 1951, the New York Times called barbiturates more of a menace to society than heroin or morphine, and declared that the matron who regards a pink pill as much of a bedtime necessity as brushing her teeth, the tense businessman who gulps a white capsule to ease his nerves before an important conference, the college student who swallows a yellow goofball to breeze through an examination, and the actor who takes a blue angel to bolster his self-confidence are aware that excessive use of barbiturates is not good for the system, but are ignorant of the extent of the hazard. You would think that such heavy consumption of barbiturates would have made drug companies keen to develop new and better nostrums. But when Frank Berger, a research scientist at the Wallace Laboratories, subsidiary of Carter Products, tried to interest company executives in a new anti-anxiety medication he had synthesized in the late 1940s, they showed no interest. For one thing, they argued, therapy for anxiety was supposed to focus on psychological issues or unresolved personal problems, not on biology or chemistry, a distinction that from the vantage point of modern biological psychiatry seems quaint. Besides, psychoactive drugs lay outside Carter's usual commercial domain, which consisted of such things as laxatives, Carter's little liver pills, deodorant, Arid, and depilatory cream, Nair. Berger had stumbled on the anti-anxiety properties of this new substance entirely by accident. Born in what is now the Czech Republic in 1913, Berger had, after earning his medical degree at the University of Prague, conducted immunology research that established him as a promising scientist. But when Hitler annexed Austria and seemed poised to claim Czechoslovakia, Berger, who was Jewish, escaped to London. Unable to find work there, Berger and his wife became homeless, sleeping on park benches and eating at soup kitchens. Eventually, Berger got a job as a doctor in a refugee camp, where he learned English, and then moved on to a job as an antibiotics researcher at the public health laboratory near Leeds. By 1941, penicillin had been demonstrated to be an effective treatment for bacterial infections. But manufacturing and preserving penicillin in quantities large enough to be useful in fighting infections among Allied soldiers proved vexing. "The mold is as temperamental as an opera singer," lamented one pharmaceutical executive. So Berger, along with hundreds of other scientists, went to work trying to find better extraction and purification techniques for the revolutionary antibiotic. He was particularly successful in developing a method for preserving the mold long enough to distribute it more widely. After his research was published in prestigious scientific journals, a British drug company offered the once homeless chemist a high-ranking position. One of the penicillin preservatives Berger tested was a compound called mefinesin, which he had synthesized by modifying a commercially available disinfectant. When he injected mice with mefinesin to test its toxicity, Berger observed something he'd never seen before. The compound had a quieting effect on the demeanor of the animals. Berger had, quite by accident, discovered the first of a revolutionary new class of drugs. When mefinesin was found to have a similar sedating effect on humans, the Squibb Corporation, recognizing a commercial opportunity, began distributing mefinesin as a drug to induce relaxation before surgery. Sold under the trade name Tolserol, mefinesin had by 1949 become one of Squibb's most prescribed drugs. But mefinesin wasn't very potent in pill form, and its effects were short-lived. Berger resolved to develop a more powerful version. In the summer of 1949, he took a job as the president and medical director of Carter's Wallace Lab subsidiary in New Brunswick, New Jersey. There, Berger and his team set to work synthesizing and testing compounds that might prove more potent than mefinesin. Eventually, they identified a dozen out of the roughly 500 they synthesized that seemed promising. After more experiments on animals, they narrowed the list down to 4 and then to 1, called meprobamate, which they patented in July 1950. Berger's team found that meprobamate relaxed mice. The effect on monkeys was even more vivid. "We had about 20 rhesus and Java monkeys," Berger would later tell the medical historian Andrea Tone. "They're vicious, and you've got to wear thick gloves and a face guard when you handle them. But after they were injected with meprobamate, they became very nice monkeys, friendly and alert." Further testing revealed meprobamate to be longer lasting than mefinesin and less toxic than barbiturates. Meanwhile, 2 new papers in top medical journals were providing the first reports of the therapeutic effects of mefinesin, which, remember, was less potent than meprobamate. One of the studies, conducted by doctors at the University of Oregon, found that when mefinesin was given to 124 patients who had sought treatment from their physicians for anxiety tension states, more than half experienced a significant reduction in anxiety, to the point where they resembled, in the words of the researchers, "individuals who are pleasantly and comfortably at ease." Other reports from mental hospitals showed similar results. Soon, the first small-scale studies of meprobamate were finding the same thing. The drug significantly reduced what doctors of the time tended to call tension. These studies were among the first to measure in any kind of systematic way the effects of a drug on the mental states of human beings. Today, when reports on randomized controlled trials of the efficacy of various psychotropic drugs are published by the score every month in newspapers and medical journals, this kind of study seems routine. But at mid-century, the notion that psychiatric drugs could be widely and safely prescribed, let alone scientifically measured, was novel. So novel, in fact, that Carter executives didn't believe there was a market for such a drug. They retained a polling company to ask 200 primary care physicians whether they would be willing to prescribe a pill that would help patients with the stresses of day-to-day life, and a large majority of them said they would not. Frustrated, Berger persisted on his own, sending meprobamate pills to two psychiatrists he knew, one in New Jersey and one in Florida, for testing. The New Jersey psychiatrist reported back that meprobamate had helped 78% of his patients suffering from what we would today call anxiety disorders. They became more sociable, slept better, and in some cases returned to work after being housebound. The psychiatrist in Florida gave the drug to 187 patients and found that 95% of those with tension improved or recovered on meprobamate. When I first came in here, I couldn't even listen to the radio. I thought I was going crazy, one of the Florida psychiatrist's patients reported after a few months on meprobamate. I now go to football games, shows, and even watch TV. My husband can't get over how relaxed I am. Berger showed these results, which the Journal of the American Medical Association would publish in April 1955, to Henry Hoyt, the president of Carter Products, who finally allowed meprobamate to be submitted for FDA approval. The custom at Carter had been to name compounds after local towns, and so meprobamate had been internally dubbed Milltown, after a small hamlet about 3 miles from Berger's lab that a guidebook called Tranquil Little Milltown. Since place names cannot be trademarked, Hoyt dropped an L, and when the pill came to market in May 1955, meprobamate was called Milltown. In 1955, barbiturates were still the most popular anti-anxiety medication. They were marketed as sedatives and had dominated the pharmacy shelves for several decades. Because they had a proven sales record, Berger wanted to market Milltown as a sedative too. But one night over dinner in Manhattan, his friend Nathan Klein, the research director of Rockland State Hospital, advised against that. "You are out of your mind," Klein said. "The world doesn't need new sedatives. What the world really needs is a tranquilizer. The world needs tranquility. Why don't you call this a tranquilizer? You will sell 10 times more." Out of such contingencies, an unexpected side effect of a penicillin preservative, a stray remark at dinner, is the history of psychopharmacology made. Milltown was brought quietly to market on May 9, 1955. Carter Products sold only $7,500 worth of the drug in each of the first 2 months it was available. But sales of the compound, which was advertised as being effective for anxiety, tension, and mental stress, soon accelerated. In December, Americans bought $500,000 worth of Milltown, and before long, they were spending tens of millions of dollars a year on Milltown prescriptions. In 1956, the drug became a cultural phenomenon. Movie stars and other celebrities sang the praises of the new tranquilizer. "If there's anything this movie business needs, it's a little tranquility," a Los Angeles newspaper columnist declared. "Once you're big enough to be somebody in Filmtown, you've just got to be knee-deep in tension and mental and emotional stress. The anxiety of trying to make it to the top is replaced by the anxiety of wondering if you're going to stay there. So big names and little alike have been loading their trusty pill boxes with this little wonder tablet." Lucille Ball's assistant kept a supply of Milltown on the set of I Love Lucy to help the actress calm down after spats with her husband, Desi Arnaz. Tennessee Williams told a magazine that he needed Milltowns, liquor, and swimming to get him through the stress of writing and producing The Night of the Iguana. The actress Tallulah Bankhead joked that she ought to have been paying taxes in New Jersey, home of Wallace Labs, because she was consuming so much Milltown. Jimmy Durante and Jerry Lewis publicly praised the drug on televised awards shows. The comedian Milton Berle took to beginning the monologues on his Tuesday night television show with, "Hi, I'm Milltown Berle." With so many prominent champions, Milltown's popularity spread nationally. Magazines wrote about happy pills and peace of mind drugs and happiness by prescription. Gala Dali, the wife of the surrealist painter Salvador Dali, was such a devotee of Milltown that she convinced Carter Products to commission a $100,000 Milltown art installation from her husband. Chrysalida, an undulating 2.5-ton tunnel meant to symbolize the Milltown-aided passage to what the painter called the nirvana of the human soul, stood in the exhibition hall at the annual meeting of the American Medical Association in 1958, surely one of the more avant-garde exhibits ever to grace a medical convention. Aldous Huxley, whom, based on the drug-addled dystopia he painted in Brave New World, you might have expected to be a stern Cassandra about such things, proselytized that the synthesis of meprobamate was more important, more genuinely revolutionary than the recent discoveries in the field of nuclear physics. Within 18 months of its introduction, Milltown had become the most prescribed and, with a possible exception of aspirin, the most consumed drug in the history of the world. At least 5% of Americans were taking it. For the first time in history, the neurologist Richard Restack would later observe, the mass treatment of anxiety in the general community seemed possible. Milltown contributed to a wholesale transformation of the way we think about anxiety. Before 1955, there was no such thing as a tranquilizer, no medication that was designed to treat anxiety per se. The first use of the word tranquilizer in English was by Benjamin Rush, a physician and signatory of the Declaration of Independence, who used the term to describe a chair he had invented to restrain psychotic patients. But within a few years, American pharmacies were full of dozens of different tranquilizers, and companies were spending hundreds of millions of dollars to develop more. The confidence of psychiatrists in the new drugs could be overweening. Testifying before Congress in 1957, Frank Berger's friend, Nathan Klein, enthused that the advent of psychiatric drugs may be of markedly greater import in the history of mankind than the atom bomb, since if these drugs provide the long-awaited key, which will unlock the mysteries of the relationship of man's chemical constitution to his psychological behavior, and provide effective means of correcting pathological needs, there may no longer be any necessity for turning thermonuclear energy to destructive purposes. Klein told a journalist from Business Week that meprobamate was good for both economic productivity, because it restored full efficiency to business executives, and artistic creativity, because it helped writers and artists break free of their neuroses and overcome mental blocks. This utopian vision of better living through chemistry may have been overblown, but it was broadly shared. By 1960, some 75% of all doctors in America were prescribing Milltown. The treatment of anxiety had begun to migrate from the psychoanalyst's couch to the family doctor's office. Soon, attempts to resolve conflicts between the id and the superego were being displaced by efforts to better calibrate the neurochemistry of the brain. The deficiencies in our description of the mind would probably vanish if we were already in a position to replace the psychological terms by physiological or chemical ones. Sigmund Freud, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, 1920. The insulin of the nervous. French psychiatrist Jean Sigwald's characterization of the newly discovered drug chlorpromazine, thorazine, 1953. Meanwhile, a series of unexpected pharmacological discoveries in France were to have medical and cultural consequences that were perhaps even further reaching than Milltown's. In 1952, Henri Laborie, a surgeon in Paris, decided to experiment on some of his patients with a compound called chlorpromazine. Chlorpromazine, like so many drugs that would find their way into the modern psychotropic arsenal, had its origins in the rapid growth of the German textile industry in the late 19th century, specifically in the industrial dyes developed by chemical companies starting in the 1880s. First synthesized as a blue dye in the 1880s, phenothiazine, chlorpromazine's parent compound, was over the decades that followed discovered to have an unlikely array of medicinal properties. It worked as an antiseptic, reducing the risk of infection, an anthelmintic, expelling parasitic worms from the body, an anti-malarial, combating malaria, and an antihistamine, preventing allergic reactions. Capitalizing on its bug-killing powers, DuPont started selling phenothiazine to farmers as an insecticide in 1935. Chlorpromazine came into being in 1950 when French researchers synthesized the new compound from phenothiazine, intending to create a more powerful antihistamine. But chlorpromazine failed to improve on existing antihistamines, so they quickly put it aside. When Laborie asked the chemical company Rhône Poulenc for some chlorpromazine, he was hoping he would find that its purported qualities as an antihistamine would help mitigate surgical shock by reducing inflammation and suppressing the body's autoimmune response to the trauma of surgery. It did. But to Laborie's surprise, the drug also sedated his patients, relaxing some of them to the point where they were, as he put it, indifferent toward the major surgical procedures they were about to undergo. "Come, look at this," Laborie reportedly said to one of the army psychiatrists on the staff of the Val de Grâce military hospital, pointing out that the tense, anxious, Mediterranean-type patients had become completely calm, even in the face of major threats to their health. Word got around the hospital, and one of Laborie's surgical colleagues would soon tell his brother-in-law, the psychiatrist Pierre Deneker, about the effects of this new compound. Intrigued, Deneker administered the drug to some of his most psychotic patients on the back wards of a Parisian mental hospital. The results were astounding. Violently agitated patients calmed down. The crazy became sane. When one of Deneker's colleagues gave it to a patient who had been non-responsive for years, the man emerged from his stupor and wanted to leave the hospital and return to his work as a barber. The doctor asked him for a shave, which the patient carefully gave him, and so the doctor discharged him. Not every case was as dramatic, but the calming effects of the drug were powerful. Neighbors reported that the noise emanating from the asylum had dropped significantly. Other small-scale experiments with the drug showed similarly potent results. In 1953, Jean Sigwald, a psychiatrist in Paris, gave chlorpromazine to 8 patients suffering from melancholia with anxiety, and 5 of them got better. Chlorpromazine was, Sigwald declared, the insulin of the nervous. Chlorpromazine came to North America when, one Sunday evening in the spring of 1953, Heinz Edgar Lehmann, a psychiatrist at McGill University in Montreal, read an article while luxuriating in his bath. The article, which had been left in his office by a drug company sales representative, reported on chlorpromazine's effect on French psychotics. "This stuff is so good that the literature alone will convince him," the salesman had told Lehmann's secretary. When Lehmann got out of the bath, he ordered a shipment of the compound, and he used it to launch the first North American trial of chlorpromazine, administering it to 70 mentally ill patients at nearby Verdun Protestant Hospital, where he served as clinical director. The results amazed him. Within weeks, patients who had been suffering from schizophrenia, major depression, and what we would today call bipolar disorder, among other psychiatric ailments, seemed effectively cured. Many found themselves completely symptom-free. Some of those who doctors had thought would be confined to asylums for life left the hospital. It was, Lehman would later say, the most dramatic breakthrough in pharmacology since the advent of anesthesia more than a century before. Smith, Klein, and French Laboratories, an American drug company, licensed chlorpromazine and in 1954 brought it to market with the trade name Thorazine. Its arrival transformed mental health care. In 1955, for the first time in a generation, the number of hospitalized mentally ill in the United States declined. This revolutionized psychiatry. Before 1955, both the acutely psychotic and the moderately neurotic were treated mainly by psychoanalysis or something like it. The working out of psychological issues or childhood traumas and talk therapy was the accepted route to mental health. No one in their right mind in psychiatry was working on drugs, Heinz Lehmann would later say of the field before the 1950s. You used shock or various psychotherapies. Together, Thorazine and Milltown reinforced a culturally ascendant new idea that mental illness was caused not by bad parenting or unresolved Oedipus complexes, but by biological imbalances, organic disturbances in the brain, that could be corrected with chemical interventions. For me, the watches of that long night passed in ghastly wakefulness, strained by dread, such dread as children only can feel. Charlotte Bronte, Jane Eyre, 1847. As it happens, my own decades-long experience with chemical interventions would begin some 25 years later with Thorazine. As I approached the end of elementary school, my proliferating array of tics and phobias drove my parents to take me to the psychiatric hospital for the evaluation where it was determined I needed intensive psychotherapy. In seventh grade, I started at a new school. One Monday morning in October, I refused to go. The prospect of separation from my parents and of exposure to germs felt too terrifying to endure. But my parents, after calling Dr. L., the psychiatrist who had conducted the Rorschach test during my evaluation at McLean Hospital and whom I was now seeing for weekly psychotherapy sessions, and Mrs. P., the social worker who was supposed to be counseling my mother and father about how to be less anxiety-inducing parents, refused to let me refuse, which led to a melodramatic standoff that would replay itself most mornings for the rest of that school year. I would wake up crying and clutching my covers, saying I was too scared to go to school. After failing to reason me out of bed, my parents would tear the covers off, and the wrestling match would begin. My father would hold me down, while my mother forced me into my clothes as I struggled to escape. Then they'd frog march me out to the car while I tried to wriggle free. During this 7-minute drive to school, I would sob and beg my parents not to make me go. As we'd pull into the school parking lot, my moment of reckoning would arrive. Would my parents have to physically remove me from the car, humiliating me in front of merciless schoolmates? School was terrifying, but so was the threat of humiliation. Wiping my tears, I'd get out of the car and begin the gangplank walk to my homeroom. My anxiety was not rational. I had nothing, really, to fear. Yet anyone who has suffered the torments of acute pathological anxiety knows that I am not exaggerating when I say I do not think I would have felt much worse had I been walking to my own beheading. Stunned by despair, blinking back tears, struggling to control my roiling bowels, I'd sit mutely at my desk, trying not to embarrass myself by bursting into sobs. My first glimpse of clinical depression came as I was sitting in class one Friday afternoon that year. I was experiencing my characteristic relief at the prospect of being sprung for the weekend when I had the thought, but on Sunday night this starts all over again. and I was chilled by the infiniteness of my plight, by the notion that Sunday nights and Monday mornings eternally return, and that only death would put a stop to them, and that therefore there was nothing, ultimately, to look forward to that might help me transcend my dread about bad things to come. By January, my phobias and separation anxieties had become so consuming that I had begun to drop my friends, and they to drop me. I scarcely socialized with my peers anymore. Engaging in the give and take of schoolboy banter had become too stressful, so at lunchtime I preferred to sit quietly beside a teacher. This put me in a position, on the first day back after holiday break that year, to overhear the Spanish teacher tell the French teacher a graphic tale of spending the holidays with friends in Manhattan, where she and her companions had been stricken by a stomach virus that had included prolific amounts of vomiting. Yes, it is a mark of the intensity of my phobic preoccupations that I can today, some 30 years later, still remember the conversation almost verbatim. This was more than I could bear on the first day back after vacation. I left school, went home, and pretty much lost my mind. Here are the snapshots I can remember from that evening. Me throwing things around the house, smashing everything I can get my hands on, while my father tries to grapple me into submission. Me lying on the floor, pounding it with my fist, screaming so hard that drool froths from my mouth, yelling that I am so scared and can't take it anymore and want to die. My father on the phone with Dr. L, talking about whether I should be committed. There is mention of straitjackets and ambulances. My father going to Corbett's, the local drugstore, and coming back with emergency doses of Valium, a minor tranquilizer of the benzodiazepine class, about which more shortly, and liquid thorazine, which was then known as a major tranquilizer and is now classified as an antipsychotic. The thorazine tasted awful, but I was desperate for relief, so I drank it in some orange juice. For the next 18 months, I was on thorazine around the clock, and starting later that week, I began also taking imipramine, the tricyclic medication that was the antidepressant of choice prior to the arrival of Prozac in the late 1980s. Imipramine did more to determine the modern conception of panic anxiety than any other drug. More about that in the next chapter. Every day for the next 2 years, my mother would place one large orange thorazine pill and an assortment of smaller green and blue imipramine pills on the edge of my plate at breakfast and at dinner. The medication reduced my anxiety enough to keep me out of the hospital, but at a cost. On thorazine, I became foggy and dehydrated, shuffling along with a dry mouth and hollowed-out emotions and twitching fingers, the result of a common thorazine side effect known as tardive dyskinesia. A year earlier, prior to going on thorazine and imipramine, I had been selected for an elite soccer team. When I showed up the following autumn in a thorazine stupor, the coaches were baffled. What had happened to the short kid who had embarrassed older players by dribbling circles around them? They now had a kid, still short, who moved slowly, tired easily, and became rapidly dehydrated, a gluey white mucus encrusted around his lips. Even after I was heavily medicated, my anxiety persisted. I'd make it to school, but then get overwhelmed by fear, leave class, and end up in the infirmary with a school nurse, begging her to let me go home. When the confines of the infirmary came to feel too claustrophobic to contain my antic pacing, she would kindly walk around school with me while I tried to calm down. Compounding matters, my phobia of vomiting metastasized around this time into a fear of choking. I started having trouble swallowing. Difficulty in swallowing has been a well-recognized symptom of anxiety since at least the late 19th century and is known clinically as dysphagia. I became afraid to eat. My skinny adolescent frame, worn ever thinner by nervous fidgeting, became emaciated. I stopped eating lunch at school. The more trouble I had swallowing, the more I'd obsess about my trouble swallowing, and the worse the trouble would get. Soon I was having trouble swallowing even my saliva. I'd sit there in history class, my mouth full of spit, terrified that if I were called upon to speak, I would choke on my mouthful of saliva or spew it all over my desk, or both. I took to carrying wads of Kleenex around with me everywhere I went, discreetly drooling into them so that I wouldn't have to swallow. By lunchtime each day, my pockets would be full of drenched tissues, which would leach into my pants and make them smell like saliva. Over the course of the day, the tissues would disintegrate, so by evening, bits of slobbery Kleenex would be spilling out of my pockets. Are you surprised to learn that I had but one date in all of middle school and high school? Seeing me wandering the campus with the nurse when I should have been in class, my peers naturally wondered what was wrong with me. The mother of an erstwhile friend ran into my mother and asked if I was ill. My mother, prevaricating, said I was fine. But I was not fine. I was miserable. In photographs from that time, I'd look hunched and hangdog and sickly, like I am shrinking into myself. I was on antipsychotics and antidepressants and tranquilizers, and I was taking daily walks with a school nurse instead of attending class. Without Thorazine and Imipramine and Valium, I don't know that I would have survived seventh grade. But I did, and by the end of eighth grade, my anxious misery had relented somewhat. Dr. L. weaned me off the Thorazine. But since that winter some 30 years ago, I have been on one psychiatric medication or another, and often two, three, or more at a time, more or less continuously, making me a living repository of the pharmacological trends and anxiety treatment of the last half century. Drug discoveries were of sensational importance for understanding psychiatric illness and the basic nature of the human condition. Our personalities, our intellects, our very culture could presumably be boiled down to a sack of enzymes. Edward Shorter, Before Prozac, 2009. For a brief period in the 1980s, I took phenylzine, a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, or MAOI, whose trade name is Nardil. My experience on MAOIs was not notably successful. I didn't feel any less anxious, but I did do a lot of worrying about whether I would die from complicating side effects of the drug. This is because MAOIs can have dangerous, even lethal side effects, especially when combined with the wrong elements. When patients taking MAOIs ingest things such as wine and other fermented alcohol, aged cheeses, pickled foods, some kinds of beans, and many over-the-counter medications that contain high levels of an amino acid derivative called tyramine, the health effects can be serious. Painful headaches, jaundice, a spike in blood pressure, and in some cases, severe internal hemorrhaging. Which means MAOIs may not be ideal for people like me who are, even in the best of circumstances, prone to hypochondria and health anxiety. For this reason, among others, while there are still depressed and anxious patients for whom MAOIs remain the most or the only effective pharmacological treatment, MAOIs have not been considered a first-line treatment for mood disorders for many years now. After trying many alternative remedies, including electroshock therapy, the novelist David Foster Wallace found Nardil to be the most effective treatment for his anxiety and depression. Going off Nardil, after experiencing what seems to have been a tyramine-induced side effect, may have precipitated Wallace's downward spiral to suicide in 2008. Though MAOIs played only a cameo role in my own psychiatric history, they are important in the scientific and cultural history of anxiety because they were among the first drugs to be specifically tied to a just-emerging neurochemical theory of mental illness. At mid-century, the advent of MAOIs in conjunction with the arrival of imipramine and the other tricyclics, about which more shortly, helped create the modern scientific understanding of depression and anxiety. MAOIs have their origins in the later years of the Second World War, when the German Luftwaffe, bombarding English cities with V-2 rockets, ran low on conventional fuel and had to resort to propelling the rockets with a fuel called hydrazine. Hydrazine is poisonous and explosive, but scientists had found that they could modify it in ways that might be medically useful. When the war ended, drug companies bought the leftover hydrazine supplies at a steep discount. The investment paid off. In 1951, scientists working at Hoffman-LaRoche in Nutley, New Jersey, discovered that two modified hydrazine compounds, isoniazid and iproniazid, inhibited the growth of tuberculosis. Clinical trials ensued. By 1952, both isoniazid and iproniazid were on the market for treatment of tuberculosis. But these antibiotics had an unexpected side effect. After being treated with them, some patients would become, as newspapers recounted, mildly euphoric, dancing through the hallways of the tuberculosis wards. Reading these reports, psychiatrists wondered if this mood-elevating effect meant that isoniazid and iproniazid might be used as psychiatric medications. In a 1956 study at Rockland State Hospital in New York, patients with various psychiatric disorders were given iproniazid for 5 weeks. Toward the end of that period, the depressed patients had improved markedly. Nathan Klein, the hospital's research director, observed what he called a psychic energizing effect, and he began prescribing iproniazid to the melancholic patients in his private practice. Some of these patients, he subsequently reported, experienced a complete remission of all symptoms. Klein would later declare that iproniazid was the first cure in all of psychiatric history to act in such a manner. In April 1957, Hoffman-LaRoche began marketing iproniazid